Hey, everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message Podcast, episode 58, and alas, the final Off Message Podcast that I'm going to appear on. I am leaving. I don't know if you folks know this. Some of you do, some of you don't. I'm going to be starting on January 3rd, working for the New York Times and leaving Politico. Someone is going to be replacing me in this particular chair, and there are going to be a lot of really great podcasts being developed by my partner in crime, Bridget Mulcahy, with whom none of this would have been possible. So I want to start off with a big shout out for Bridget, who's been with me every step of the way. Whatever you liked about this, you pretty much give 50% or more like 60% to Bridget for mellowing me out and telling me when I was talking too much, like right now. but really, without her judgment, without her technical expertise, and she's also a hell of a fun person to be out on the road with. Anyway, I don't want to get too sentimental today, but I do want to talk a little bit about the most sentimental topic of all, how I got into doing this, why I really enjoy it. And I've actually put some thought about this in the last couple of days. And like everything else, it comes down to my folks, my parents. My mother was the best listener I have ever known in my entire life. Back in the 1970s, when you actually had to pay for your long-distance bill, we would run up $300 and $400 long-distance bills because my mother would be sitting and talking to her friends who were scattered around the country, and you really wouldn't hear her say anything. You would just hear her listening to other people. She just had this incredible gift for listening, which I have inherited, again, about 50% of. The most extraordinary thing about my mom is you would go into a supermarket with her, and she would tell you to go up to the aisle and get some wooden spoons or go up to the aisle and get some Brillo pads. And you would come back, and she would be locked in conversation with a person she had met 10 seconds later. And more often than not, this person would be hugging her and crying on her shoulder. This was the power that she had in terms of opening people up and really listening to them. And also, more than anything else, respecting the fact that everybody had their story to tell. She died too young. It would have been nice to have her around to see some of this stuff, to listen to some of this stuff, to give me some feedback. But to her, I owe an enormous debt of gratitude. To the extent to which I'm decent at this, I owe it to my mom. My dad was a different kind of character. He was 5'6" tall. He died in 2010 after a long struggle with Alzheimer's. And he was a mechanical genius and a guy who was a little bit at war with the world. His favorite expression that he would use copiously, particularly when talking with me, was bullshit. You would say something to Richard Thrush, and he would say, bullshit. I think that is kind of the other half of my whole shtick, is the fact that I have a healthy sense of skepticism. So it's pretty clear for me how I came about wanting to do this kind of work. When I say it's clear to me, of course, it took 2 decades of therapy, but my folks are really the reason I got into journalism, and I think why podcasting in particular is appealing to me. My father also was a really, really good listener. So insofar as I have been successful at this, it has been through the listening, less so the talking. So I will cut it off right there. The one thing I do want to say, though, however, I have gotten hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of wonderful emails and texts from people over the past year, and we've done this for about a year, really being unbelievably supportive, offering up suggestions on how I could improve, advice on how to do the show better, political observations, sometimes criticism, but the vast majority of people have been incredibly generous and really, really encouraging. This has been just one of the best experiences of my life, both professionally and personally. And 2016, for a lot of people, was a lousy year. This really got me through the year. And again, the last folks I'd like to thank are the guests. When we first started doing this, the idea was to kind of copy Marc Maron, who Bridget and I both adored. And what was cool about Marc Maron is he's a little bit older than me. But he, too, had kind of a journeyman's career. So he'd been at the bottom, middle, and working his way up kind of late in life in his profession. So he had a real view of of all the layers of his profession, and he loves show business. I mean, he really digs it. So he would be interviewing a whole broad range of people in that business with a real curiosity about how they did their job, what their experience was like. I felt I was the Marc Maron of politics. I love politicians and I love journalists. So when I go on Twitter and I see people pissing all over reporters and politicians, you know, obviously criticism is important. It's valid. But you're talking about my people here. And the one question that I had when we were doing this, would politicians who get paid to obfuscate, to create false images, to project their best side, would politicians open up to me in the way that entertainers or stand-up comics would open up to Marc Maron? And you know what? It turned out they did. It turned out that everybody has a story to tell. And as my mother taught me, if you're respectful, if you really listen, if you have an open mind, an open heart, people will tell you their stories. So overall, I'd like to thank everybody for giving me the opportunity to allow other people to tell their stories. And here is Chuck Todd. So you're from Miami, right?
I am from Miami.
What'd you folks do?
Born and raised. So my dad he had a lot of jobs. He wasn't successfully employed very often. But my dad, when I was really young, was a record company local promoter. So he worked for A&M Records and he worked for Atlantic as sort of the local rep. The evidence I have of this is I probably have as large of a vinyl collection as anybody can have of records that have never been sold, meaning there are all these like A&M promotion, and of course it's vinyl, I won't get rid of it. But I, like some of it is, you know, it was always kind of cool as I was becoming an adolescent and then started listening to my own music. And I remember, you know, as anybody, you just, you know, every 12-year-old or 13-year-old thinks they've discovered Led Zeppelin. And they get into their Led Zeppelin, and I remember.
Because they were Atlantic, right?
Swan Song. They were like Atlantic, exactly.
Yeah.
Look at you. That was what my dad could do. My dad, he was that annoying guy. Literally, the song would hit the radio, and he knew the label, you know, the producer, all of that stuff. It's what he, you know. Anyway, that's what he was early. And anyway, when I realized sort of the depth of his knowledge of the record industry, Led Zeppelin IV. You know, the untitled Led Zeppelin IV, Zoffo, whatever everybody wants to call it. Everybody called it their own thing, Zoffo, whatever right. that thing was. And I'd be like, you know, and I didn't, my dad would say, oh, you know, I own some Led Zeppelin. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, I didn't believe him. And boom, 1, 2, and 3 come out in that, you know, with the nice little.
Wow.
Well, the beautiful albums, except, of course, with the faded, you know, so the browning, because it probably had been through one too many AC leaks in our apartment.
Mildew, that nice.
The mildew. Oh, I've got. All of my vinyl has some form of mildew, but over time, it warps into place, is what I've
noticed. Zeppelin III had that amazing album cover. I forgot the name of the guy.
It's not good anymore.
The one my version with the rotating wheel on it.
It's a great look. All of their covers were interesting. They did a lot of
There was
of
a
great.
Name of a guy who did them all, and he did all. The other, okay, but total rando here. Wasn't Phil Hartman? Did you know this about Phil Hartman? Phil Hartman started off his career as an album jacket designer.
I didn't know. I had no idea. That's
and like he did a couple of famous ones, like REO Speedwagon, maybe the Cars.
Oh, REO Speedwagon always looked like somebody was on LSD.
Well, I think they were actually on LSD.
That's what makes the best album covers, right?
I heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend.
Anyway, so that was my dad. My mom. My mom was the one that always had two jobs.
Like what kind of jobs?
Just so she was always retail. She worked for one company for a long time, was a district manager, Park Lane. Then she went into real estate after my dad died.
And how old was your dad?
My dad was 40 when he died. I was 16.
Am I allowed?
Sure. No. He died of, actually was having a lengthy conversation about my wife about this lately, because he died of Hep C, of hepatitis C, in 1988. And it's been interesting to see the advertising lately come out. That says, hey, if you're a baby boomer, you're most susceptible to hepatitis C. And there's various reasons for it. The biggest one is blood transfusions.
Right.
My dad was in a bad car accident when he was 19 or 20,
right,
down in the Keys. And he did get a blood transfusion. And that is, they think, 18 years or 15 years later, that it sort of was dormant.
And it destroys the liver, right?
Destroys the liver. Drinking doesn't help,
right?
When you're a drinker, and my father was a drinker, so it may have sped up the virus a little bit. But it has been sort of disconcerting, I'll be honest. That here I think I've always grown up in the modern world.
Right.
Right. You and I have grown up in the modern world.
Right.
But to know that half a life ago,
right,
they couldn't cure the disease that my father had. Today,
it's containable.
Today, they give him a couple of pills,
and
he's fine.
That's right. They have the one pill now.
And I'm just, I have to say, they had no clue what to do about hepatitis C in 1988. And literally, he was on the liver transplant list. He wasn't stable enough for it. Or as I used to say, he wasn't Mickey Mantle, so he couldn't get three of them.
Yep.
I just wanted one for the old man. But it is one of those that has been hard to watch. I have, and this is also the month that he died, November's the month that he died. But I've had a hard time seeing that PSA lately about Hep C because it's like,
I could see it. My mother died. My mother died when she was 50 of a brain aneurysm, and that was also
preventable now.
Preventable because she died of was she had to have the iodine transfusion, and she was allergic to shellfish. So she essentially died of the allergic reaction to the shellfish, and now they could do it through imaging. So you're on the cusp of it. You're 5-7 years away.
Right.
I've had that same
You just have it, and it's like there's nothing you can do about it.
Right in the middle,
you're just like, God, but for...
It's like a lost love. It's like, it's this feeling of yearning.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I know exactly how you feel. Well, let's move on to something fun.
Sure.
No, but I mean like, but let's talk about your dad again for a second. You were sitting here in your office at NBC, and you got a lot of stuff. And it's not just a lot of stuff. It's a lot of interesting stuff. You have a lot of different disparate interests. It sounds to me like your dad was a stuff guy. And I mean sort of intellectually, artistically.
Yeah.
He was an accumulator of fact. He was an accumulator of observation. Does he sound? Is that
That's an interesting way of describing? 100%.
Yeah.
Pretty eclectic. He was the skill that he had that I've always was in awe of. It's that he learned how to speed read.
Really.
And it is I remember, and I just didn't believe he read a couple of these books, and I literally quizzed him, and he did. And then he taught me, and I've learned a little bit how to do this.
By reading like paragraph at a time?
You read diagonally is actually how he described it. How he described it for himself. Now, I'm sure other people who are proficient in actual speed reading and how it, you know.
Right.
But essentially, he said the way his mind works, if you read diagonally, right, you're grabbing words in a paragraph.
Right.
You take a paragraph, and you're essentially from the top left corner to the bottom right corner,
right,
and you read that way. So as a skimming tool, I've always found that very helpful. I still can't find myself a full-fledged speed reader that day, but that was something. And he was just, no doubt he had disparate interests. Here's what I've always said. My father sort of had, he had a rough childhood. He grew up in a way that today, we grown up sort of semi-single parent, we'd be fine. But when you grew up semi-single parent in the 50s and 60s,
tough.
And I say semi, but when the father is off with another woman back and forth, it's a lot tougher. It was a lot tougher on his mother then.
Right.
And she had her own challenges, so it gave challenges to him. The bottom line is, I feel like I am finishing the career my father always should have pursued. He would have been very good at this.
I feel
he never got there, and it is. I'm sorry, we can't talk about this job.
With my dad, I learned how to interview by talking to my dad. Was he somebody? When you have a parent like that, it makes you a better listener. It makes you a more sensitive listener. It makes you more sensitive to sort of where they're coming from. How did you sort of, because you're a good listener, you're an engaging conversationalist, where do you think you sort of picked that up?
Oh, 100% from him. My dad was one of those, and somebody else made the observation once, and my dad always did it intuitively. So my dad was an extraordinarily private person, and he wanted that for us.
Right.
And it was always this idea. I was an only child, and he always used to say, look, it's the three of us. We're an open book, but what happens here stays here. You know, it was always this idea. So he's an extraordinarily private person. But he was always the guy everybody loved to hang out with. He was the affable guy. And the trick was, that he and I, when somebody said this to me years later, not about my father, but it going back, and it was actually James Carville one time said it to me, and I'm, so we're having a working lunch,
right?
And we essentially ran out of stuff to talk about.
Carville,
it was very early on. It's like 20 years ago.
And people should know he's just a blast.
He is, but it was like one of those things, and we were specifically working on an idea when I was at Hotline, working on an idea. And we literally were like, okay, we were done, but we were stuck having to finish our meal. It was just like, it was not personal. It was just sort of, and he goes, you know, and I'm not going to try to do a Carville. Everybody wants to do a Carville. He goes, let me give you a piece of advice. Whenever you talk to somebody, don't talk about yourself, just talk about their children.
Right.
He said, if you talk about their children, they'll think you're the greatest person in the world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it was sort of like, and he was like, well, A, he's right. It was sort of a salesman trick.
Right.
Right. And it's essentially, my dad was very good at always making people that, you know, he wanted to be the life of the party with booze a little bit.
Right.
And we always had, you know, we may not have a lot of money, but boy, we had to make sure we had every single potential mixed the ingredients for a mixed drink for anybody that might walk into the house at any moment in time.
Remember those diner menus that would have like the
He was that like that was so but it was all about, so when you say it's listening, it's all about making about somebody else.
Oh, always yeah,
and that,
yeah,
and it in sort of like, and that is sort of the life I led.
And I find it very difficult. Like, what I've been on air with you, you're very disciplined about that, I think. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes, as I'm learning how to do this, which it takes a lot of doing, I think the bigger component of this is figuring out when to really shut the hell up, which I'll do more of right now. So you went away.
It's tough on podcasts, I'll be honest. As a podcast listener, it's the thing I'm trying to discover with podcasts. I think people want the conversation.
Well, I like it. I mean, it makes me feel
good. It's not an interview. It's a conversation.
No, that's the whole thing. And I find the reason I started doing this was because I wanted to repeat my off-the-record interactions with people.
I know.
In a way
and
that they could hear.
I'm with you. It's trying to recreate it. And it's like what's frustrating about the podcast format, and I say this loving it at the same time, is that why can't we get this on television? Like, why is this so difficult to get? What is it about the gosh darn camera?
Answer that question. Well, same thing with the briefing room.
I don't know.
Right.
I mean, I think part of it is I don't want to, you know, what would keep me from slouching and doing this, right? You don't want to, you feel that there's a formality to television, even in an informal setting, that you feel like you have to, like a minimum bar. But is there? Like you know what I mean?
Well, if Trump can change it for politicians.
Why can't, right, that's right. And I have been in this, I don't know, like why can't we create this model? And I think part of it is people seek, I've answered my own question on this in this respect. A podcast is for people that want more.
That's right.
In television, you are there to get people that are both passive and active on your story, whether they're passively interested or actively
and
interested.
And you'll get attacked.
Podcast is about you're actively interested. So so you don't have to explain, oh, by the way, so-and-so was this person, and so-and-so was that person.
On-demand versus ambient.
But it is making me long. Like, how do we at least bring this part of the...
Sid Caesar had a great line when he shut down your show of shows. He said...
I love that you say it's your show of shows as if, like, me working at NBC Today somehow made me, like, you know, me and Grant Tinker, you know, somehow tinkered with
May
it.
May he rest in peace.
May he rest in peace.
His line was, why did he stop his show when it was at the height of his popularity? It was because more people were buying TVs and the audience was less informed. And he said the room got too big.
That's an interesting way of doing it. I do think, so you work at a publication that some people say that the publication I worked at was sort of the precursor to it.
Totally.
The Hotline, precursor to the Political.
Yep.
And you know what's interesting is I was rooting for the idea of Politico because I wanted the room bigger.
Right.
I thought this was great.
Right.
I really think. I don't know how. I don't know if I would argue that today. It's funny you say that. I think the bigger the room, the certain things you can't say analytically that you did in a smaller room.
I agree
on politics, and it's not. This is not about whether. It's just that the bigger room doesn't hear what you're trying to say. It's not to say that they're not sophisticated. It's not about a sophistication, but it's about speaking in a shorthand and speaking in a professional shorthand that when you say it to a bigger room, people will take offense to it in ways that it was never designed to be offensive. It was simply designed to be academic.
Well, let's extend the metaphor even more. I think it's a different dynamic. I think the room is not only bigger, but you've got people who are talking to each other while you're talking mm-hmm. and hecklers.
Right. They're actually not listening to what you're saying.
Right.
It's like giving a speech and everybody is talking
and trackers,
right at the same time.
And they
time.
Come and yeah. there's a bunch of people who are coming to that room with the specific purpose of fucking with you. So like, which I'm not a big fan of all this bedwetting self-analysis. I think on the aggregate, media did fine. I think like anybody who needed to know anything about either of these two candidates had more than enough information to make an informed
choice.
Look,
I've thought about this a long time. I mean, the issue, and I've been working on an op-ed that I haven't decided whether I even want to publish or not. But it's more of trying to get to this arc of like, how did we get here? How did we go where there is this issue where the public doesn't trust the so-called mainstream media? And it's, you know, I keep. What I do is I'll start 5 years and I'm like, no, you have to go back further. Nope, you have to go back further. And I go back, you know, first I say, boy, does it begin with when television media started hiring political practitioners mm-hmm. to be members of the media?
Right.
Did it start then? And then I thought, no, you could actually go back this way. You know what I mean? You can keep going back. I think we're in a cycle. I mean, one of the things is don't forget rumor and innuendo outpaced factual reporting in the 19th century constant.
Right.
Okay. Constantly. Go read about any contentious presidential election between basically post-Civil War.
Hey, people talk about Hamilton.
That's right. It looks right. No. So the point is, right. is that we have been through this stage before.
Right.
I will say this. I think the current iteration of the press where we went from where the press was the hero of Vietnam.
Right.
And the press was the hero of Watergate.
Right.
Okay, this was hero journalism. You know, sort of, you know, the same type of journalism is still being practiced today. It's just that more people have decided to take a rooting interest into the information. Right.
Yeah.
There is that, right, affirmation versus information. But I am frustrated that there are a handful of loud partisan voices that are members of the bigger picture media.
Yeah.
That somehow their inaccurate and aggressive agendas paint those who are just practicing straightforward, like
right.
what happened today and
right.
why did it matter?
Right.
You know, two most important questions I deal with, what and why.
Right.
More importantly than anything else.
Right.
And I believe my job is the why more than it is any, you know, that's why NBC hired me for why, not
right.
for what. And it's just drowned out, right? It's just that it's so loud over on the fringes, the big names, that we've eroded that over time. And then the other thing is we've not defended our industry.
Well, that I think is a big one because
it drives me batty.
It drives me nuts. I think because we have been the subject of a systematic campaign to discredit us
Correct.
For 3 decades.
Oh, it starts with
yep.
it, look. I look. It,
Remember
it,
Reed Irvine?
Yeah,
that almost
no.
Seems
it
like
all
kids
started
play
with
now.
It all started. Yeah. It was the Nixon. And I don't put this ideologically. Because this is not about conservatives. This was right. about Nixon defenders. Remember, there was Nixon defenders post Watergate.
Yep.
That were not with the rest of the Republican
yep.
Party. It was Nixon defenders that made it an obsession to get Woodward and Bernstein.
Right.
Right. And it all began there, and that is the root. Roger Ailes was part of that group.
Right.
People forget that.
Right.
And it sort
so
of.
So was Roger Stone.
You know, and it's sort of right. No, in many yeah. ways, Ailes, this is the ultimate sort of like, here we are.
Totally.
And the system that Ailes and Stone have been trying to create for right. 40 years, here we are.
You got to wonder, though, if this is the, if is this the final, is this the fruit ripening and falling off the tree, or is it a new tree?
There you go.
Right? I mean, that's the big question.
It is it? Is this the right? Is this the end or the beginning?
Right. So okay. So let's talk a little bit about. Well, let's talk a little bit about the campaign. Let me hit you with the one potential criticism that I have. Tell me a little bit about why this is just totally my hobby horse. Tell me how from sort of an arms race perspective, because I think what people fail to realize is just how competitive your particular seat is in terms of booking and stuff. Mm-hmm. How did this phenomenon of Trump being able to call into the Sunday shows, explain to me the evolution of that and how you feel about it now?
It was copycat. I'm just going to straight up saying I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
A competitor did it first. I'm not going to sit here and whine about that.
It was George, I think, right?
I don't know who did it first. Okay. If it was George or
okay.
I can tell you we did it not in response to George. We did it in response to somebody else who did it. And we felt trapped. It was one of those you feel as if you feel as if, well, you can have it that way or have nothing.
Right.
And at the end of the day, and this is where I do think we in the media looked silly arguing about this. Because I will make the case in defending, as much as I didn't like the phoners either.
Right.
And I just finally stood my ground and was the first Sunday show to
say
no more. Others did it, and we have stood stand pat, and I'm not going to do it anymore. I can't. We have it a rationale in 15, fine. Once 16 started, we didn't do it again. But I will say this. I think a satellite interview is just as hard to control as a phone interview. Yes, okay, the phone interviews.
Right.
I actually think I did my best to get something out of the phone interviews. If they were the only thing we were getting in lieu of like face-to-faces, it would have been more problematic. But the public, we were arguing about this, and this is the stuff that I think the public criticism of the media is so insular, and is the fact that we were having these arguments and all of the big J journalists were like lecturing us. And first of all, every print reporter out there, you know what? You let me know how many telephone interviews you've done, how many email interviews, all that stuff. There was no criticism I accepted less that I took less seriously than criticism from a print reporter about doing a phoner. I'm sorry. Print reporters only do phoners.
No, we do.
It was like it was the worst criticism was the criticism that came from those folks.
Right,
like unacceptable. But overall, it made us look ridiculous.
Well, it's I think,
and that's the part of this that I thought
it's not the look.
Us fighting about it made us look ridiculous.
Oh no, I'll give you one point of disagreement. And by the way, you're totally right on the print reporter stuff, but you do have a different platform.
There's no doubt, and I want to keep it special. And this is why.
And this is a dude. Hold on, a mutual source of ours who we were talking about in the Trump camp before we turned on record here said this to me, that Trump never has walked off a set and said, "How did I sound?" All he wants to know is how he looked. Right? The visuals for Trump are key. And you know something? He's smarter than you or me about this stuff.
Oh, I have interviewed him multiple times.
Yeah.
The amount of time he spends after the interview is over with the sound off, he wants to see what it all looked like. He will watch the whole thing with mute.
Are you kidding me?
No.
So he'll sit there and kind of look at the sound off?
Yep. He's very, very mindful.
He's a very visual guy.
Very, well, you saw, I thought, and by the way, it wasn't surprising me. I saw an interview that our friend Chris Eliza did with the media consultant for Trump who made the ads. And if he talked about how he decided to hire an apprentice, a crew that had shot The Apprentice, knew how to shoot him, and shared the same story about how attentive Trump was to visuals. In fact, and this guy loved it because this was the first candidate that didn't care about the script as much as he cared about the visuals. Said, "We'll worry about the script later. Let's look at the visuals." The visual issue with him is not just for himself. He is very much, this is, he thinks this way. And look, it's an important insight in just understanding him. But the visual stuff is very real beyond just himself.
And to take it one step further, his aesthetic is different than ours. That's the other thing.
Oh, right. What you think looks good. And what
scowl. So this is something I asked early on. I was like, I think Kellyanne or somebody, or maybe even Roger, where I was like, what's with this goddamn scowl all the time? Like, who thinks, like, remember Crippled? First of all, the book was called Crippled America. And I was like, that's the craziest. That's the most anti-Reagan thing I've ever heard of in my entire life.
Right.
Like, who the hell, and puts this look on the front page like he's in a windstorm, right? Like he's squinting in a windstorm. He thinks, and he turned out to be right, that is a projection of strength.
Well, yes. Here's another observation that drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I've never seen him laugh.
Trump?
Yeah. Laugh. Ask yourself.
Like actually have an honest reaction and laugh at someone's joke.
Yeah.
No.
And I challenge somebody to find him laughing, and that person's yet to find an example of him laughing. He'll smile, but he smiles appropriately. Watch him at the Al Smith dinner.
Or the correspondence dinner.
That's right.
He's not laughing. He'll laugh at his own joke a little bit.
No, a little, but he doesn't really laugh. He looks for others to laugh. It is just a weird. It was one of those things that over time, I've just been waiting to see him laugh. I want to genuinely look.
Let the record show. Bridget's jaw is now on the floor. You're totally right.
Barack Obama. We've seen him like caught in laughter.
Right.
Wait. Just that where you're bellied over, whatever it is. It is. I'm sure it's happened for him, but for some reason he never is caught on camera. Never is caught truly laughing.
Well, we could talk about fathers doing a number on sons. There was that unbelievable, I think we had it. No, I think it was maybe in the Wayne Barrett book where a reporter jokingly walked up to Fred Trump and said some joke about your son being killed in a plane crash. And like Fred Trump laughed about it. Like there was the dynamic between Fred Trump and Donald Trump is fascinating.
Well, look, he's not the first president to have daddy issues.
Right.
In fact, I have an argument among my unwritten books is about presidents and their daddy issues. The point being this, and in fact, my wife and I have taken it a step further. Yeah. We think successful people need a chip.
Right.
That basically what and there's nothing like a parental issue to add a chip.
And with men, their fathers, Teddy Roosevelt being the principal.
Look, my name's Chuck Todd, and I have a chip on my shoulder about my dad. You know, everybody has the chip. For Barack Obama, it was where's dad?
Right.
Bill Clinton was where's dad? For George W. Bush, it's living up to dad. For George H.W. Bush, living up to dad. It is fascinating. There's something about, and look, I think one of the undercovered aspects of Hillary Clinton is her relationship with her father was very, very troubling because I think her father was just a
tough,
a
borderline. You don't want to use the word. But
no, you don't want to use the M word. Yeah. But basically, this was a 1950s father.
Right.
Because my mother grew up very similarly.
Right.
In fact, similar part of Illinois. She grew up with a family business. It was offered to the son, not the daughters.
Right.
Right? That sort of atmosphere. This was the 1950s. That is how she grew up.
Even though she was the Cordelia to his Lear.
But the two boys got all the attention. The two boys, you know, the football player of Penn State. And, you know, so, again, it was a driver for her.
Yeah.
It definitely, you could see it. There was something about it.
First five chapter of Carl Bernstein's book on her really write about that in a way that no one else did. But back to the pajama interviews for one sec. The one thing I would say about that, and I do want to challenge you on that. You are totally right about print reporters. And you know, I got nailed on some WikiLeaks stuff where I'm doing my trade craft and it does not look good when it's exposed to the light of day.
Mm-hmm.
So I fess up on that stuff. But the one thing is, we're talking about visuals and impressions of power. This is the same thing with the empty podium shtick when CNN and MSNBC showed the empty podium. By saying you are willing to, this is a guy who's very interested in leverage and power dynamics.
Sure.
When you are saying, I will accept you on the phone, and I haven't accepted other people on the phone, didn't that send a message to voters that this guy is more important and more powerful than other people?
It may have sent that message. It wasn't obviously nobody.
Right.
Nobody was thinking about that in this way. It was. Look,
Do you think he was? Do you think he was thinking?
No, he'd been doing phone interviews with CNBC and Fox Business and Fox and Friends for the last 5 years, right? Contractually, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
It was like Mondays were Fox and Friends days, Tuesdays was CNBC day, or vice versa, whatever it is. But so he was doing this for the last 5 years. So. For him, it was just a normalized routine. Sometimes he does TV interviews, but for the most part, if, you know, I'll do phoners and, that show won't take it. Well, that show will. You know, you want to talk about a problem that makes it so that you want to take a stand.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody wants to take a stand when it comes to, you should refuse to print this and you should refuse to do this. We're so fractured that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So you do have to ask yourself, Is it better to ask him questions and make him answer and get some answers out of him? Or is it better not to have asked those questions at all?
Right.
And
but you did decide not to do it any longer.
Because it felt it look, for Sunday morning, I said this, I will do it on my cable TV show.
Right.
That's different. I will not do it on Sunday mornings. I do feel like Sunday morning, I was preserving something on Sunday morning.
Did you change his behavior?
I'll be honest with you. Yeah. So we said no. He threw out a phone and we said no. Why not a TV studio in Palm Beach? And they said yes.
And that changed dynamic.
For me, and I was like, okay.
See, I agree with you. I disagreed with your point about the satellite stuff because I think
I don't think satellite's that much different.
Make him put on a pair of shoes and tie his tie.
Look, but they could still be in pajamas. They could still be whatever. I don't think it is as, put it this way. If every one of your print reporting stories, they're not as good unless you tell me everybody you interviewed is face-to-face so that you have their expressions. Point is, I hear you, but imagine if you set that bar as your job, would you ever get a print story done?
I will tell you something. I do, I'd say, now I have the luxury, unlike a lot of my colleagues, of being liberated from a lot of deadlines. So when I'm working on a piece for 6 weeks, I'll talk with somebody on the phone a couple of times and then we'll meet up and I'll look at them in the eye. And that's a totally different, as you know, that's a totally different dynamic.
Of
you can interrupt people.
Oh, yeah. Look, face-to-face is the most important thing. So the biggest criticism I get on interviews usually is, you're rude to so-and-so.
Right.
And it won't matter if it's left or right. You were so rude to so-and-so. Anytime anybody's accused me of being rude, it's been on a satellite interview.
No kidding.
Nobody ever accuses me of being rude in a face-to-face. Because why?
Right.
For those that are not, I'm giving visual cues.
And by the way, you are a gesticulation junkie.
Yes, I totally will admit that. I absolutely, if I, what is it, the joke about Rahm Emanuel when he chopped his middle finger off, it rendered him mute.
That's right.
If you chopped my hands off, it would render me, then my stubs would be coming around. You'd really have to get me at the shoulders.
Ick, by
you'd
the
have
way.
To walk, you'd have to Walking Dead me.
Yuck.
Right, which is to get rid of the full arms, and then I'd be, who knows. But the point is you can do visual cues. There's so many ways. Without it seeming argumentative.
Right.
On a satellite, it's annoying to the viewer.
Right.
It's not good for the viewer. What's best for the viewer is that face-to-face dynamic.
Who's the best at this that you've ever seen? Like when you were first, because by the way, you made a big leap up from,
It's interesting you say that. I've been all over the map on what I find, the different ways that I find, it depends on the different styles work for different people. So I don't think one style that I would say sticks out. So Tim had a very specific style, and that worked really well for people in power all the time. But you wouldn't want to use the same style for every person that you had on there. I don't think anybody does a. And so, for instance, I'll give you this. I think Matt Lauer in a 5-minute interview. I don't think there's anybody in America that can get more out of 5 minutes
than Lauer.
Than Lauer, and he's obviously he has to be good at
right.
that. I am always stunned and impressed with how well, because I can tell you how many times that I'll do it. It's like you do a pre-tape. That first 5 minutes is you want to do over again.
Right.
Right. You can't. Well, you don't get that luxury on morning television. So
what is that about? Compression? About establishing likability? The fact that everyone knows who Matt Lauer is already?
No, I think it's just something that you perfect over time. I think I'm always more impressed. It's not the interviews with people you're familiar with.
Right.
It's how it's the interview like when the Oakland fire or the tornado being it's that. But I think he is really good at getting a lot in less than 5 minutes, so that's what I mean.
Right.
There's different styles and different.
But it sounds to me like you're very restless. Like you feel, I mean, you're just very restless about the medium. You're thinking about the medium.
100%.
You're at the apex of where you are and I'm not going to say you're trapped because you have a lot of modalities. You do the MTP daily thing, which must be a real relief for you. You're able to sort of do it in a different way.
Oh, the point of, it's funny you say that. Yes. I've added a lot of things to what Meet the Press is. Meet the Press Daily.
Right.
We're now doing a podcast. We're doing some other things. Ultimately, it all gets at scratching my own itches.
Right.
Which is, that's what 100% true, which is, look, I want to go. I would do Mike Pence for the full hour, which 10 years ago we would have done, right? Tim would have done, and the viewer would have accepted it. Viewer doesn't accept that anymore. You're a trap of the viewer.
Is there okay?
There is evidence on that.
No, there's evidence, but is there any way that you can change? You know, politicians talk about this all the time. Trump, I think, or Kellyanne said it today at an event that we did, mm-hmm. where you change. We don't. Reagan didn't use polling to tell him which way the wind was blowing. He used it as a way to lead. Right? Mm-hmm. Is there any way that you could take the hit on that and see if you can't take an audience with you? Or is the
Look for certain guests. Yes. Gone 30 minutes with Obama. We've done 30 minutes with Trump.
Right.
Did 30 minutes with Hillary. The point is that yes, but I think there's only a handful of people, unfortunately, that sustain the viewer attention. And at the end of the day, you know, there's always multiple dynamics in there. So for instance, I think you can't do, I want John Brennan for a full hour.
Yeah, me too.
But I don't know if you can fill the room. We were talking about filling the room.
Yep.
I don't know if you can fill the room for everybody else for the full hour. And so now I've got multiple ways to still do that full hour somehow.
Right.
So the best 15 minutes is on Sunday and then this and this.
But
and
the
this,
problem, you know, though, is you it would be really cool to be able to pull that stuff into the period of maximum amplification.
Of course. Right. And the thing is that we are dealing in a fragmented world where there's, you know, at the end of the day, we're still only.
Yep.
You know, we still only have a finite amount of space.
Let me add just a couple more questions, and I want to end on something else. But with Trump in general, we're dealing with both a president and a candidate who has an estranged relationship from the truth. I don't think there's any other way to sort of characterize that. That's been proven.
Well, he's a marketer. He's a salesman. I've never met a salesman that didn't exaggerate or worse.
Right.
And ultimately, I think one of the things that we always got to remember about him, because he actually has the salesman mentality. He will never say a negative word about you in person.
It's true. Your face.
To your face. He will always compliment. Always find a way to compliment. I mean, he said every salesman trick in the book. I mean, it's almost like go read Dale Carnegie.
You really feel like you're getting the Dale Carnegie.
I feel like sometimes I've gotten the Dale Carnegie. Not all the time. We've had, the longer we've gotten to know each other, the blunter we are with each other. Maybe that's healthy. Maybe it's unhealthy. I don't know. I think I go back and forth that I sometimes say, I think of Trump as the character in what was the agent movie? Show Me the Money. Show Me the Money movie. The Cuba Gooding.
Cuban
Gooding Jr.'s character.
Tim Cruise.
Tom Cruise and him are yelling at each other, and he says, "You think we're yelling at each other? We're just starting to communicate."
Right.
I actually think. When Trump riles you up and you banter back with him,
right,
he's like, great, now we're finally communicating.
Is he self-deprecating in private?
No.
So is he, I don't want to ask you if he's a normal guy, because he's clearly demonstrated he's not a normal guy.
But by the way.
I know.
No, I don't think politicians are normal.
No, I know. Okay. Well.
No, but relative, whatever normal is.
There's a spectrum.
I say it this way. I think it's not everybody. It is a different type of personality that needs public affirmation to do a job. It's a weird dynamic. You know, I don't know if I would have the guts.
Right.
I admire people that have the guts to put their positions at the will of a bunch of people they don't know. And the fact that at the end of the day, their success or failure depends on what those people they don't know think of them. When we use the word normal, people say what's not normal, and somebody will take it out of context that we're saying politicians aren't normal. But this is not normal. It's not a normalized thing. It's different.
It's why people would say the beer thing with George W. Bush, a guy who hadn't had a drink in 30 years.
Yeah, I mean, it just goes to, I think that, and especially presidents, I mean,
but wait.
How many people look in the mirror and think, I can run the world?
Well, wait a second. How many people look in the mirror and can't stop looking in the mirror? That's the other thing, right? The question with him is, is he interactive enough with people? Is he enough of a listener? Is he somebody who can, you mentioned the laugh thing, you mentioned the self-deprecating thing. Is this guy capable of processing inputs in a normal enough way to make rational decisions?
I think so.
What gives you that confidence?
He doesn't want to be unpopular. That's a powerful thing. And I think ultimately, if everybody's like, the guardrail, there's a lot of guardrails in our democracy. All right. The founders are amazing. It is amazing. When you think about it, just read the emoluments clause, and then you realize, good God, what didn't these guys think of?
Right. You were about to say something else.
No. I mean this in a positive way. It's like there's always...
I was going to get you to say the F word.
No, the Constitution.
Yeah.
They thought of... And I loved it. It was a constitutional professor who said this. He says, you know, the beauty of the Constitution is there's some parts of it that lie dormant until it shouldn't.
Yeah.
You know, the emoluments clause is a perfect example of one. But the other guardrails we have is popularity. The other guardrails you have is sometimes personal success or failure. You know, what is Trump's main beef with the media? Its main beef is when he doesn't feel like he's getting praised or
right.
he's getting enough credit or whatever it is. But what does that also tell you about him? He wants to be seen as successful.
And you feel
and he wants to be successful. So
and that's ultimately the frame that the picture gets painted in.
And I think that's the frame he's gonna and look, I think he's an any means necessary kind of guy.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's going to present massive challenges to our system.
What do you think?
I think he's a transactional guy at the end of the day. Whether it's negotiating with you or me on when to interview him, he doesn't like having somebody else in between making those decisions.
Yep.
Whether it's dealing with my director to find out the right lighting right. for him, or whether it's dealing
which he has picking, done
right, or yeah. picking up the phone and having his own conversation with the head of Carrier.
Right.
Rather than having the chief of staff make the call. The
right.
point is that that's who he is. He's kind of hands-on. He's kind of transactional, which is what a sales guy is, right?
Right.
You work for yourself. Ultimately, you eat what you kill.
Right.
And so when you say, okay, so he's got quirks, a lot of personality
yeah.
quirks. I ultimately believe the guardrails for him are popularity, and that matters to him.
One last thing I want to – there's a splinter in your biography. There's just something – that just kind of sticks out. You were you didn't graduate from GW, but you were a music minor,
double major for a while.
And you did composition, right?
Oh, it was GW didn't have this, but I essentially was trying to create my own music performance major. Other music schools have music performance. I was a French horn player.
You're a French horn player.
Mm-hmm.
For those people who do not know, it is the most complicated brass instrument to play, right?
Of course. and it's the instrument with the most range. I have a 5-octave range on it.
What do they call the embrasure?
Embouchure.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Sorry,
it's all right. But you can almost go as low as a tuba, and if you're really good, go as high as a trumpet or a cornet. So the point is, you can create. There's a lot of range you have with a French horn that other brass instruments don't. So I was trying to create a performance major out of there. So, you know, it was.
What made you get into the French horn?
We're going to end where we began.
Yeah.
My dad played the French horn.
Really?
Yes. And he was pretty good at it.
And degree of difficulty was important, too.
He said, if you're going to. So music was a big part. My father, my grandfather played it. Both my grandparents played instruments. My father and his sister were. Music was a big part of life. So, you know, I had piano lessons starting at 5 and hammered into me, didn't love it, but was musically theory. I was in music theory wise. I caught onto it.
Well,
real
that's
fast.
Piano, right?
That's piano. Yeah. You learn it and all that
yep.
stuff. And when I picked an instrument, my dad always said, look, you can be a great trumpet player and go nowhere. You can be a great French horn player and get free college. He was right.
Was he supportive?
100%.
I mean, like when you play and stuff, was he?
He was tough. He was tough. What was interesting is I ended up having the same teacher as him for a while that he used back in the day. And he was ridiculously supportive, but never wanted to. He was afraid of turning me off the instrument. He was afraid of, it was a weird dynamic that he had.
Wow.
He wasn't comfortable pushing it. The only reason I picked it is because of him. And then all of a sudden he backed way off. And looking back, I'm disappointed in that. But I think it was his own personal failures in his life. I think he felt as if he wasn't very successful career-wise. Just had a bunch of careers that just didn't work out. But he was really good. He was a really good musician. And I think it was just, for him, it was a reminder of yet another unfulfilled
But also a repository of his self-confidence and a knowledge that he was able to do. Do you play the French horn? Do you play anything?
Yes, a little bit. What do you, number one, Gridiron sort of roped me back into playing French
Mozart
horn.
Was composed for it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the famous Mozart concertos were done as a gag, what people don't know.
Oh, really?
They were originally done as a gag because it was actually written before the French horn had vowels. So I'm not going to get into the history of it. But there was a time in the French horn where the hand, so, you know, you see people put the hand in the bell.
Right.
And you actually, you use their hand to change pitch a little bit.
Well, that's the way all music,
And so the old, basically German postal, the French horn is a derivative of the old German postal horn, you know, announcing that the mail is here, and it's just like one little circle of brass. Anyway, and the Mozart concertos were Mozart playing a gag on his pal, who was a French horn player. Now they're terrific. They're probably, arguably, among his most... people don't go listen to a Mozart concerto, you realize, oh my God, it gets played all the time.
All the time.
All the time. Sort of overhead music, elevator music, department store music, you name it, and it's always played.
Last question. Do you ever compose anything?
Oh, I had to. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't enjoy music composition. It was one of those things when you take it as a class, right? And you're forced to write stuff. Bach chorale, you know, and you literally are moving up the history of music and you're having to write a Bach chorale and all this stuff. So, you know, I dabbled a little bit in trying to compose, but I didn't, I wanted to master the stuff that was already there.
What's the residual of all that and what you do right now? That's it. Final question.
Residual? I think music, helps reinforce discipline in life. And I think that you never master music,
right?
You continue, but it is sort of a, you know, you have the lessons you learn with music. You got to practice. You got to be determined. You got to be focused. I just think it's in the same way that I believe this, the one sport that did more for me, that taught me more about working with others than any other is football. Okay. And I've always been of two minds on the whole football issue. For kids, because on one hand, I mean, you know, 10 other people relying on you not to make a mistake. That's a huge life important lesson.
Right.
Huge. That you individually cannot succeed without the 10 other people. Gigantic. Music in a different way taught me a type of discipline that I would like to think helps me do that.
Well, not to make you toot your own horn, but thanks.
Hey, look at that, a horn gag. Dad humor.
Thanks, Chuck.
We could out-dad humor each other here.
Yes, we could.
All right, brother.
Take care.